It is 3:06 on a Friday afternoon. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Bill Nigut. You're listening across the state of Georgia to Political Rewind. I got to say, we've had a lot of fun weeks in politics in the last year, certainly covering the presidential race, but there's been some really interesting state issues going on. This, from my point of view, has been one of the most entertaining weeks yet in the presidential race. But before we even get there, there's also some fascinating stories to talk about in terms of issues right here in the state of Georgia. Joining me this week, as he always does, thank goodness, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jim,
good afternoon.
Always glad to have you here. Of course, you read his column in the Dead Tree edition of the AJC on Thursdays and Sundays. You read him all the time on Political Insider, the AJC.com blog that keeps you informed on politics literally hour by hour, Mr. Galloway.
We hope so.
Also joining us, Dr. Andra Gillespie. She is an associate professor of political science at Emory University. We always love having you here. Thanks for being here, Andra.
Thank you. I enjoy being here.
And we also have Todd Rehm. He is a Republican political consultant. He is also the editor of GeorgiaPundit.com, which on a daily basis keeps you up to speed on national, state. And one of the things Todd does really well is also to cover, he gets down into, Todd, you get down in there. You talk about state legislative races. You talk about city municipal races. You're a great source for that sort of thing.
Thank you very much. Always happy to be here.
All right. Joining us again, because you were so good the last time you were here, Billy Linville. He's a Democratic political strategist, and we're always happy to invite you to the table. Thanks for being here, Billy.
Thank you, Bill.
All right. So let's do this. We've been starting with presidential politics for quite a while now, and for good reason. There's a lot going on. But right now, there's some pressing matters in state politics that we ought to talk about. One of them, of course, Jim, is we are now, we've talked about this before, we're kind of reading the tea leaves. We're about 3 days Tuesday from the deadline when Nathan Deal has to decide what to do about the remaining bills on his desk. And the big one is
campus carry.
Yeah, okay.
And we just got a note from the governor's office this afternoon which said he's going to sign the budget on Monday. Usually a governor will hold that back and make that the very, very last thing. But he's going to sign the budget Monday. Tuesday, he'll make us guest till Tuesday.
Well, I'll tell you what. He had a signing event the other day on another bill we're going to talk about. And, of course, was surrounded by reporters who wanted to know what he was thinking about campus carry. Here's what he said.
It makes it one of those tough choices that a governor has to make. But I think that's one of the things that the governor is supposed to do, is make the hard choices, to not necessarily play the political game that may be associated with issues like this, but to do what's in the best interest of as many Georgians as possible.
All right, so I throw this open to the group. I'll start with you, Jim. Any tea leaves to be read here at all?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Look, and I think I've said this here before. For the first, you know, 3-4 weeks after the session ended, I felt sure that he was going to sign this bill. After he vetoed religious liberty, I thought I was even more convinced. And that clip alone tells me that he may not. He may veto that one too.
Andre, you're nodding.
Well, I don't know if I know so much as I hope that this is what he's going to send. I actually just had lunch with somebody today when we were talking about aggressive students in our classes. And, you know, we teach at a private school, so this does not affect us. But for my friends and colleagues who do teach at public schools around the state, when you're dealing with students who can get really anxious about things sometimes and are sometimes a little impulsive, having guns on college campuses is just not a good mix. And so, you know, I hope for the safety of all students in the state of Georgia that he does this. Governor Deal has taken some bold steps in recent weeks, and he's been willing to take the heat on certain types of issues. And so he might have the gumption to dare his party and to dare the General Assembly on this one, too.
Yeah, you know, Todd, Billy, I came away from hearing this soundbite from the governor in the same way that Jim did. I thought he was opening the door. Yeah, governors have to make tough decisions. That's why we're here, to make these tough decisions. Todd, it sounded to me like a guy who might be preparing to say, I can't sign this bill. Or are Jim and I just typical reporters looking for some kind of excitement?
No, I think what's heightened the anxiety of a lot of us who are trying to figure out what's going to happen is that I don't think there have been any clear tells You know, and so we've had a series of statements that we can read either way. I think what is partly happening is I'm not certain that Governor Deal is certain or has decided finally what he's going to do yet. You know, his way of governing has always been very deliberative. And you'll see this in the way he deals with the General Assembly, often not weighing in early in the process, but sort of waiting towards the end. And I think we may be seeing a governor's mind at work.
Billy, are there consequences to the governor's decision on this for legislative races and other races that are coming up?
Well, I believe that Governor Deal is going to veto this legislation. I think he sent a clear message toward the end of the session that it needed changes. After the veto of religious liberty, in which he received praise not just throughout Georgia but throughout the country, I think it's going to further embolden him to do what I think in his heart he wants to do, which is veto this legislation. I think that it will create some activity, certainly with Republican primary voters and the state and local Republican parties continuing their anger regarding religious liberty. So I think it could definitely have impacts on the primaries.
If I could be allowed to argue on both sides of the issue, the one specific way this differs from religious liberty is you have not heard corporate Georgia come in on this issue like they did with religious liberty. They have stayed out of it. So it is, I mean, the constituency in this argument is far less powerful, I think.
All right. So let's remind our listeners that when this bill passed the legislature, by quite wide margins in both the House and Senate, Governor Deal, the path that he took to this is interesting, I think, Andra, because he first signaled that he was all for this legislation. And then after it passed and it came to his office, he said, well, yeah, but there are certain conditions that I'd like to impose on this bill. And I'm asking legislators to take it back, take another look at it. They said no. It's an interesting progression.
Right. And so the conditions were to think about ways to protect minor visitors who come on college campuses. So in particular, if you have high school students who come on college campuses to take classes for dual enrollment or because they're coming to visit to look at the school, or if you have a college campus where there's a daycare center, for instance, and so a lot of faculty and graduate students use that for their children. And so those are loopholes to actually prevent this from actually being applicable anyplace else. And it's also banned in places like athletic venues, and it's supposed to be in, I think, fraternities and sororities too, as well, where people know that there's a lot of alcohol. So by basically creating these no gun zones, you've almost covered the entire campus because you can't really control where the high school kids go. And by taking a lot of dormitory space for all intents and purposes and a lot of athletic space out of it, there are very few places where you can't say that minor children aren't going. And that was the part that got ignored. And so if you're going to have that many caveats, it seems like there are too many loopholes in it for this to actually be viable.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things occurs to me, I went to law school on a campus that had that allowed guns. And this was in rural Southwest Virginia. And one of the things that I think we don't consider is we're always fixated on the Atlanta area campuses, which may have different needs and different student bodies than a military college in North Georgia. And a blanket rule may not be the right approach. But the other hallmark of Governor Deal's tenure, I think, is not just the deliberative nature of the way he works, but he also sort of looks at all the tools in front of him, including executive orders, including agency actions. And we may, you know, he may and his staff may be looking at what combination of agency actions or working with the Board of Regents along with either the veto or signature of this bill can bring it closer to what he's looking for.
So he could, we've talked about this briefly the other day, he could presumably veto the bill that the legislature gave him and then issue an executive order allowing campus carry with the restrictions that, as Andra pointed out, he wanted them to pass in the first place.
Right, but he could also sign the bill and then also issue an executive order that limiting the reach of that
bill.
Oh,
he can. Now, that's interesting. I didn't know he had the power to do that. Fascinating.
And I think there's something to be said for the Board of Regents having an independent constitutional authority over the institutions of higher learning. And it might be a time that an organization that has not done stuff independently much might be looking to flex its authority.
And some House Republicans that I've spoken to are so worried that he may veto it that now they're hoping that he just won't do anything and will allow it to come to law that way.
All right, so let me get a little bit more Machiavellian here if I could, Jim. You pointed out something fascinating, the order of the final bill signings. The governor's going to sign the budget on Monday, which presumably there will be a number of legislators who will be rewarded in the budget. Their districts will get projects. They care about money. They care about. Right. So they'll, on Monday afternoon, feel pretty good about the governor, which puts him in a nice position on Tuesday to say, you got your money, leave me alone on campus carry. Is that overthinking this?
I'm not sure that reality works that way. I mean, because that would infer some sort of gratitude on the part of a politician. And I don't think that works into the equation here. I think once the signing of a budget, yay or nay, for an individual legislator is a kind of an act of freedom there. It doesn't matter anymore what he says or what he doesn't say.
Okay, let me throw in one last thing, and then we'll move on to other conversations. You all check me on my facts here. The Board of Regents, which has opposed this legislation all along, Hank Huckabee, who was a Nathan Deal appointee, right?
Right.
Okay, so he is the top man on the Board of Regents. He's the chancellor of the university mm-hmm. system, which gives him a certain amount of sway with the guy who gave him that job and who the governor counts on in that job.
You would think there was a meeting of the minds there, yeah.
Okay, so Todd, do we have any reason to think that will have a big influence by the time Tuesday rolls around?
I think that Governor Deal has been, he's chosen to put people in the positions he has for good reasons. And I think he has paid special attention to the Board of Regents over the years.
Yeah.
And I would expect that should he decide there's something that needs the cooperation of the university system to make a palatable decision, that he would be looking at them, expecting them to go along in some fashion.
All right, one final observation on this, Billy. Republicans, like Governor Deal, have been adamantly opposed to President Obama for issuing executive orders on immigration. In fact, Georgia is one of the litigants in the Supreme Court against the president's executive order. Anything ironic about the potential that this governor could issue an executive order that would overturn the action or modify the action of his own legislature?
I think that you'll see some very negative reactions to that, even especially if it's vetoed. But, of course, you know, George W. Bush offered more executive decisions than President Obama has, and that hasn't created any concern with Republicans.
Todd, do you think, this is going to be viewed as an unauthorized, I'm not finding the right words right now, that it's taking an action that ought to be the legislature's prerogative?
I think that there are two things clear about the Republican electorate. One is that some of them don't want to see any action by any government body, agency, executive, legislative ever. And you're just not going to make those folks happy. But the other is that there is, among a lot of people, there's not a blanket disdain for executive action. There are some things that's simply the way government should be working. It's a question of whether it's overreach or not.
Okay, let's move on. Because although Nathan Deal is certain to not get praise from all quarters, no matter what he does on this measure on Tuesday, this week, Jim Galloway, he signed the latest in a series of criminal reform measures that he has engineered. I think it's fair to say to help felons, and it's more lower level felons,
right,
find a new way in life, to cut down on recidivism, to offer them a path to turning their lives around. Yes,
right. Yes, and it's got a humanitarian aspect, and it's got a very Republican oriented budgetary aspect to it, because locking people up and throwing away the key costs lots and lots of money in many ways.
I'm sorry. This week, among other things, the measure that he signed, it takes away the prohibition against giving felons access to food stamps that Georgia has had in place for some time, Andra.
So, I mean, and that could be a help or an aid against recidivism because, you know, if people can't eat, then they might find illegal ways in order to be able to meet some of their basic needs. And so, I mean, you know, just for logical consistency, that makes sense.
All right. So who should come forward and sing the governor's praises? But one of his dearest friends in government, Jim, the president of the United States, Barack Obama.
Amazing politics. I love that. I love this.
President said, I applaud Georgia and Governor Nathan Deal for demonstrating that making our criminal justice system more fair is a bipartisan idea. And he goes on to say, I hope Georgia's progress will encourage Congress to send me a significant criminal justice bill soon.
Who might he have been looking at?
Well, okay, let's back up and explain this for listeners who have not been keeping up quite as closely on this. Todd, there is a big criminal justice reform package, another one, pending in Congress right now, right? And it has bipartisan support, and it looked as if it was moving right along until our junior senator, David Perdue, stepped in.
Yeah, and this was not something that was on my radar. I didn't think that Perdue has been fairly middle of the road, and I was surprised that somebody coming from Georgia who has seen what I think now the mainstream of Republican thought is on how we deal with felons. I was surprised by it.
Yeah, Perdue basically says he's worried, right, Jim, that the new legislation is written so broadly that it could release dangerous felons.
Right, after some improvements were made, he says that you could still have violent offenders released who might become violent again. And, of course, that's the risk that any kind of criminal justice reform takes. But you've had a whole lot of other Republicans in Georgia kind of backdeal on this, specifically Doug Collins up in North Georgia, who has really taken part in this on the House side.
Billy, you've been working on this, haven't you?
Yes, I was in Washington last week with Linda Klein and the American Bar Association, Georgia Bar Association, and they met with the entire Georgia delegation about this issue and others. And I think a lot of...
Can I ask whether Perdue was in the room?
He was not in the room, but his general counsel was.
Right. And so where does this all stand now?
Well, I think a lot of Republicans in the Senate and a lot of Republican advocacy groups like FreedomWorks, for example, who have been working on this for a couple years, do feel blindsided by Senator Perdue and Senator Cotton from Arkansas. But I think too much work has been done for it to fall apart at this stage. So I think they will ultimately come to a compromise and a resolution.
Andre, is David Perdue safe in playing to the Republican base in Georgia by staking out this position?
I'd say probably for now he probably is, because I'm not quite sure how salient this issue is going to be in terms of people bringing it up to try to besmirch his reputation. I would say in the long term, though, especially given the bipartisan support on some issues related to criminal justice reform, it's the type of thing that could help drag him down if he wants to kind of be considered the standard bearer in the party.
Interesting. What do you think about that, Todd?
I think that... This is not something that I've seen a lot of passion on from the grassroots. I expected initially when Nathan Deal first started talking about criminal justice reform, I thought there would be a hue and cry against it among day-to-day Republicans, and there hasn't been that. But at the same time, I haven't seen a whole lot of active people cheering this on from the grassroots. So I'm not sure that it has much effect.
Well, but Jim, here's where Political Insider keeps us up to speed. You all in the column online the other day reported that FreedomWorks, which is basically a Tea Party-based organization, they came out and condemned the senators, David Perdue by name, for not supporting this bill. And their press release said, it is disappointing to see Senator Perdue make such misleading and hypocritical statements about the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. hypocritical. That's really a powerful blow.
Yeah, and it's look, it's this has no, you don't see rank and file Republicans jumping up and down on this, but this is a big issue among libertarian-minded Republicans. Yeah. This speaks of government overreach, over control by government.
Yeah, I think also it damages the brand of the Republican Party, especially on the congressional side, because as the elections approach, they want to demonstrate to people that they can actually do something and accomplish something. And if this is defeated, it just reminds everyone that Congress is broken and the Republicans are still in charge.
All right, Billy Linville gets the last word in segment one of today's Political Rewind. It is 3:26 on Friday afternoon. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we have so much to talk about, especially in terms of the Republican race in Indiana. You're listening to Political Rewind, right back.
Thanks to you and everyone who helped move our recent spring membership campaign forward at warp speed. You told us you'd appreciate a shorter drive. We listened, and together we tried something new. It worked. For the first time, we were able to shave 4 days off of our on-air fundraising campaign. If we didn't hear from you during the drive, your contribution now can still make a difference. Please go to gpb.org and click donate. Thanks so much for supporting Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Dr. Andra Gillespie, Todd Rehm, Billy Linville, Jim Galloway, all around the table here this afternoon. We're going to talk about presidential politics. What a fascinating week. Yes, Andra Gillespie, lots happening in Indiana, particularly which votes next Tuesday. And the assumption is that this is a do-or-die moment for Ted Cruz, yeah?
Well, it's a do-or-die moment for Ted Cruz for two reasons. One, he, you know, entered that pact with John Kasich. So the idea is that they consolidate their votes and they should actually be able to stay.
Now, he married John Kasich, had a very quick divorce, and then married Carly Fiorina in short order, yes?
It's really kind of complicated. So, you know, so the pack kind of phrase, but the logic of it is still supposed to hold. That that Kasich voters in Indiana should vote for Cruz, and that Cruz voters should then vote for Kasich in the ways that they decided to divvy up states. So that part phrase, but that should still hold. So it's the question of, in a two-man race, can Cruz actually beat Trump? And that's not clear. And then there is an attempt to entice people to vote for Cruz over Trump. He trots out Carly Fiorina, who sings, and then creating all kinds of you know, interesting optics.
She was a Twitter phenomenon because of that little song that she says she makes up for the Cruz kids on the campaign bus. Jim Galloway, we're going to get to Trump in a minute, and we know that he got a very big endorsement. But if you're Ted Cruz, there is one endorsement, I think, in Indiana that you hope you can get. He's been the guy who stood outside all of this. Everybody's been looking at the governor of Indiana to see what he's going to do.
Right, Mike Pence. Or did you mean Bobby Knight?
No. we'll get to that. Let's listen. Mike Pence, just a little while before we came on the air, finally did what Ted Cruz had hoped he would do, certainly. He gave kind of an endorsement to Ted Cruz.
Let me say, I've come to my decision about who I'm supporting, and I'm not against anybody, but I will be voting for Ted Cruz in the upcoming Republican primary. I see Ted Cruz as a principled conservative who's dedicated his career to advocating the Reagan agenda, and I'm pleased to support him.
Jim, he went on to say that, but I'll support whoever the Republicans nominate, and I applaud Donald Trump for bringing the disaffected Republican.
Not the sterling endorsement that you really want several days before the vote. But just to take issue a little bit with something that Andra said, is that this alliance, this Kasich-Cruz alliance, was designed to give one member of the alliance an advantage in a two-man race. And the problem is that with those votes in the Northeastern Corridor, five states where in each state Trump cleared 60%, that doesn't work. Right. If Trump clears with that margin in Indiana, you know, what's the alliance about?
Well, I mean, and that's why a lot of people thought that the alliance was half-baked to begin with, including me, and I've said this publicly kind of in the New York Times in nicer words. But I mean, you know, so that's why I think people, and that's also probably the reason why people backed off of the logic immediately. So, you know, Kasich and Cruz, I mean, this is one of their Hail Mary passes this week. I think Carly Fiorina is the other Hail Mary pass. They're trying anything that they can do because I think people are still really having, while many people have come to accept the fact that Donald Trump is likely to be the nominee, there are still many who are having a hard time accepting it, and they're going to try to do anything.
Todd, the polls show this is a single-digit race with Trump a little bit ahead.
Well, and what we've seen historically is that Ted Cruz has tended to outperform his poll numbers. Trump has occasionally, not most recently, but has occasionally underperformed his poll numbers, and that goes down to the question of organizing. But I wonder two things. I wonder if it is giving the electorate more credit for paying attention to what they're supposed to do. Because as far as I know, all three candidates will remain on the ballot in all these states. And I'm not sure if your average Indiana Republican has been paying attention to this much information. And I also thought it was counterintuitive. I would have thought that Kasich would be the stronger candidate in Indiana.
Hasn't happened. So I said at the very beginning of the show, this has been a bad week for Ted Cruz. I think most people would agree it has been. The endorsement of Mike Pence helps him. It gives him a lift at the end of the week. What didn't help him was the remarks of the former Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, John Boehner. He was at an event where he was reflecting on his life and his career. I must caution you, many of you have already heard this, but I must caution you, he was caught off mic. There wasn't a microphone right on him, so it's a little muddy, but I think you can make out what he's saying, and you really need to hear it from him rather than our telling you. Although when we come back, we will, for those of you who didn't get it, we'll tell you.
Ted Cruz, Lucifer in the flesh. I am afraid of getting along with almost everybody. I'm in Washington, I have many Democrat friends, and I have Republican friends, and I get along with almost everybody. But I have never worked with a more miserable son of a bitch.
All right, if you didn't hear it, Lucifer in the flesh. I've never worked with a more miserable son of a bitch. Representative Peter King, a Republican from Long Island, later said, boy, I think that gives Lucifer a bad name, Jim.
Well, and also one thing that wasn't in the audio was that kind of a backhanded endorsement of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
He referred to him as a texting and golfing buddy.
So how would you, Todd, what do you think when you hear your former speaker making these comments about a Republican candidate for president?
It's not the worst thing I've heard from a former Republican speaker this week. but I will say this. I'm going to question whether it really hurts Cruz that much. This is a guy who many would say was driven out of office by the right wing of his own party. And for those who are looking for the most anti-establishment Republican, it enhances Ted Cruz's claim to have been that guy.
Yeah, Billy, you're a political consultant. I think you try to turn, spin straw into gold. And here's how Ted Cruz tried to do that.
He allowed his inner Trump to come out. John Boehner, in his remarks, described Donald Trump as his texting and golfing buddy. So if you want someone that's a texting and golfing buddy, if you're happy with John Boehner as Speaker of the House and you want a president like John Boehner, Donald Trump's your man. Boehner's comments, he said something like, he's the worst SOB I've ever worked with, something like that.
Lucifer in the flesh.
Well, there was that too. But the interesting thing is, he said that I've ever worked with. I've never worked with John Boehner.
Actually, that's not quite so. He was John Boehner's lawyer back in the late 90s.
Yeah, I'd like to see a political fact check on that one. Billy?
I actually think this was a devastating week in Indiana for Ted Cruz. I think the speaker's comments have received a great deal of play in the state. But two of the things that happened this week that I think will make Donald Trump the winner. One was the endorsement of Bobby Knight, which was probably the most important endorsement.
We're going to talk about that in a minute, yeah.
And the second, when because Indiana is such a basketball crazy state.
Well, we're going to talk about that. Don't you put that away yet? We're not ready for you. Don't jump this agenda. Andra Gillespie, wait. I want to give you a chance to say something. I'm channeling Ted Cruz in throwing it to you. This guy's, you know, we have teased Hillary Clinton and been accused of sexism for talking about the quality of her voice when she starts getting into a loud mode. But, oh, my gosh, oh, the Ted Cruz speaking manner is just gets more and more grating, doesn't it? I mean, he may be great. He may be the best choice for president, but he's got to change that up.
Well, you know, I mentioned this the last time that I was on this show, where I suggested that Ted Cruz had no game and had no swagger, and that was part of the problem. And so I think it's the voice, it's the style, it's the everything is like my high school and college debates. You know, it's my roommate who can't stand me and tweets it about it all the time. I mean, there are all of these things about him. I think it is his fundamental weakness as a candidate that actually in part helps to open the door for somebody like Donald Trump. If Ted Cruz had been likable, you might not have seen as many people flock to Donald Trump, because at least your establishment and your mainstream conservatives, even your far right mainstream conservatives, could have rallied around him as being the more seasoned candidate. And because people can't stand Ted Cruz, and he's going to have to reckon with himself about that. When this is all over, he's really going to have to sit down with himself and probably a counselor and work through and understand why people hate him so much. I mean, you have to, you know, this is the part of a presidential contest that's part popularity contest. And if you don't know how to be likable, and if you have a reputation for not being able to work well with people, then that says something about your character and your ability to be able to lead.
Todd, all this said, and I'm going to give you your chance, this is the choice of a great many Georgians right now, Republicans who will go to the convention in Cleveland and have Ted Cruz as their second choice should the nomination not get decided on the first ballot.
I want to say two things. One is that I can't believe I'm in the room with somebody who prefers Donald Trump's voice to that of anybody else. and sitting to my left is another person who thinks Trump is more likable than anybody else.
But fair enough.
I get Dr. Gillespie's. I get what she's saying, because at points of my life I've been that guy. And a lot of us in the Georgia Republican have been that, have been that nerd. And I think that's partly what she's talking about with respect to Ted Cruz's personality, or perhaps lack thereof.
Well, there's being a nerd, and then there's, because I realize I'm on the air, being a jackhole. And that is in fact the difference. And yes, Donald Trump is definitely one of those, and he says horrible things, but he has a wit and a savvy about how he does it that for some reason is appealing. It's not what I would want in terms of what I would see in a presidential candidate, but he just doesn't have it. And then it has a hard time accepting it, and then gets mad if you point it out. And just, it all looks petulant and bad.
Now, I don't want to spend too much time on the virtues of nerds, but there is a very thin line for between nerddom and between being the jackhole. It's that passion. And only somebody who can be passionate about constitutional law can really thrive in this environment, I think.
Okay. Look,
I like the nomenclature here. I think we're making progress.
All right. Look, I know you've all waited. Billy, you almost jumped the gun on this, but I wanted you to hold off because it is now time for us to play Indiana Presidential Sports. All right, here we go. It's amazing. Well, no, it isn't. In Indiana, of course, sports came into play this week in the political race, the presidential race, among two candidates. Let's start with the fact you mentioned him. When you get Bob Knight's endorsement in Indiana, Jim, whoo.
Oh, that matters. It matters. I mean, this rings game is an important thing. The basketball ring, the net and everything.
Yeah, it's great. Well, we're going to get to that. But before we even get there, Billy, you know, if you're Donald Trump, you do love the idea of standing next to the greatest icon of Indiana sports, except maybe Larry Bird, when he tells you how important you'll be, how important it is that the people of this country vote for your man, their man, Donald Trump. You love standing next to him, unless perhaps he says this.
We got to talk about this presidential crap just for a moment here. You know, just you older folks remember this. Your mothers, fathers have taught you this. I'll tell you who they said wasn't presidential. I don't even know what the hell presidential means, but they told him that he wasn't presidential. That guy was Harry Truman. And Harry Truman, with what he did in dropping and having the guts to drop the bomb in 1944, saved billions of American lives. And that's what Harry Truman did, and he became one of the three great presidents of the United States. And here's a man who would do the same thing because he's going to become one of the four great presidents of the United States.
So, Jim, I can't help it. The image I get in my head is, you know, you're Donald Trump. You're at a party. There's a beautiful young woman who you're trying to flirt with, and your drunken uncle comes up and throws his arm around
you. Oh, no. You want this drunken uncle. I had visions. I was thrown back into high school where, if you know, and this galls one of my teacher daughters here, that your social studies and history is always done by your coach. I mean, that's where they stick your coach. And you got a few things wrong. I mean, the bomb was dropped in 45. Two bombs were dropped in 45. And we still don't have a billion Americans. Yeah. So it was a little factually challenged.
Yeah.
And it ended up with Trump's people very quickly getting on the cable news shows saying this was a metaphorical comment by Bobby Knight. Trump doesn't really want to drop that bomb.
Where is that Barry Goldwater, that anti-Goldwater mushroom cloud?
The mushroom cloud ad?
Time to find it in the archives.
Well, actually, that one, I've been wondering why somebody hasn't actually pulled that ad out before. You know, I don't know what's worse, that or Donald Trump, you know, talking about policy toward Tanzania in his foreign policy speech. I mean, you know, so, you know, his is still a problematic candidacy. There's still issues, even if he wins the nomination, with how does he pivot, you know, in a general election cycle, and what does that put him? Where does that put him vis-a-vis Hillary Clinton, who, by the way, he made some really sexist comments against this week. So,
by the way, that said, I mean, I didn't really explain my earlier remarks. Ted Cruz was trying to play a scene out of Hoosiers.
Oh yeah,
one
absolutely.
Of my favorite movies.
That's exactly what he was doing. He was talking about measure the height of this the basket. Well, we're going to get to that.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Yet. Okay. We're not there yet. Okay. All right. All right. I didn't know this was plotted.
You know, if you're going to, why don't we do this? I'm trying to do the presidential Indiana sports report. So let's go to the Ted Cruz sports news.
Well, as y'all know, we're here on the Hickory basketball court. Tell me something. How tall is that basketball rim? 10 feet. You know, the amazing thing is that basketball rim here in Indiana, it's the same height as it is in New York City and every other place in this country. And there is nothing that Hoosiers cannot do.
There you go. Billy, Ted Cruz talking about that old basketball ring.
Well, being a Hoosier, which is a basketball crazy state, that was probably the most devastating remark Cruz could have made. But I think the endorsement of Bobby Knight may help certainly Donald Trump in Indiana. But it's going to be a very difficult for him in the long run because it plays to a narrative that already exists with Donald Trump, that he's emotional, he doesn't have the temperament to be president. And when you have someone with the same problems that Bobby Knight has talking about dropping nuclear weapons, I think it just continues to build this narrative that Donald Trump should not be commander-in-chief.
All right, so Todd, I want you to jump in, but I do want to take a breath long enough to say, look, I mean, we are having fun with both Trump and Cruz today because, let's face it, they gave us the material. But, I mean, in long campaigns like this, everybody gets caught up in a bad moment like Cruz did. But Billy's probably right. It's the wrong bad moment to have in Indiana.
Well, and when we were listening to the Bobby Knight speech, I thought this is the perfect perfect endorsement in terms of temperament, in terms of worldview. You could send him out and he would be the perfect surrogate speaker for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But I grew up, I spent part of my childhood in Ohio, and I think it's hard for people in Georgia to understand how important basketball is in an area where you have, you know, 4 to 6 months of just inhospitable outdoors, and it's really the only outlet. I was in a small town called Wadsworth, Ohio, and the year our basketball team went to the state championship was the biggest thing that had happened to that town in 200 years. I would argue that basketball is more important in the Midwest than football, arguably, in the South. And so this was a huge endorsement for Trump.
For Trump, and a bad move, an unfortunate misuse of words by Cruz.
Yeah, and I just want to say, conversely, on the other side, is that two big things happened this week. Bernie Sanders laid off 200 employees.
Yeah, we'll talk about Democrats in a second here. I think that's right. But, Jim, just because you started your observation, we should give you a chance to finish. The pictures, Hoosiers. Gene Hackman, the coach of a team that comes out of nowhere. Hickory, Indiana, exactly. They're going to the state championship. They come into that colossal coliseum in Indianapolis. And what does Hackman do?
Well, he gets his orders his young men to, I think that one had to sit on the shoulders of another to drop the tape measure and just make sure that the dimensions were the same here in this big city as they are in the small town. I mean, Cruz was trying to make that point, and if he had stuck with that the phrase "rim," it would have worked fine.
Yeah, I gotta say it was kind of a smart thing to do.
But when you don't say hoop, when you say hoops instead of rings.
But again, it seemed very staged, like Senator Cruz speaking style. There's just an inauthenticity about it.
Right, and I think that that's been my larger point when I say that he has no swagger. Like, this is him attempting to try too hard and not actually being completely comfortable with his material. And so if he were himself, it might be better, but we might not like that person.
You know, I'm not sure about that. I mean, the one thing I know about Ted Cruz after 8 months of campaigning is that he's a movie freak.
But he's not a sports guy.
No, he's a
sports,
movie freak.
Sports metaphors are not his... are not common language for him, and I think we've seen very little sports talk the way that you see from other
candidates. All right, Todd, you get the last word in this break. Let's, though, conclude by saying this. Is there anyone at the table who believes that calling it a basketball ring instead of a hoop is the determining factor in whether Ted Cruz wins or loses Indiana? It's interesting. But is this going to cost him an election? Are we?
I think it's 1 or 2 points.
No, I wouldn't even say that much. I mean,
okay.
Yeah.
So
it will contribute to his defeat.
We acknowledge that we've had fun with this and that it was a misstep, and it does play into a larger scenario about him. But it's not going to make the difference in Indiana. I'll tell you what we're going to do. It's 3:40, almost 3:49. We're going to take our final break. Come back. We have some more interesting presidential news and state news to deal with. You're listening to Political Rewind.
In the manufacturing state of Indiana, two cities, Kokomo, an old auto town saved by President Obama's Chrysler bailout, and Gary, a steel city with ties to Republican frontrunner Donald Trump.
Trump promised that he'd build the tallest, greatest hotels. I heard him say this out of his own mouth.
The best of times, the worst of times. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 o'clock right here on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind with Jim Galloway, Billy Linville, Todd Rehm, and Dr. Andra Gillespie. We're at Politics GPB if you want to tweet us. Michael Littlefield sent us a tweet on, here's what he said. We'll get to Democrats in a minute at 3:47. Michael Littlefield is not happy. I understand, Billy Linville, that we haven't spent as much time on Democrats this week, but hey, this is not the week that Democrats are really in the hot seat, are they?
No, and this was a significant week for Hillary Clinton. I think she's
talk about it.
Certainly the presumptive nominee now. I think that Bernie Sanders... hopefully, we'll start shifting his message more toward the platform and the convention and bringing along his voters in November. He did lay off over 200 employees of the campaign. And interesting, as a demonstration of Hillary's confidence, she has pulled all funding for television, not just in Indiana, but also in California and other states.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting move on her part, Jim Galloway.
Oh, no, you're telling me something new. I've been
stuck
in a hole
here. She is not spending a penny. I thought it was up to California. Does it include California?
It includes California.
Wow, okay. So she says, I'm on my way.
Yeah. She took the Democratic race off the front burner. It's now on the back burner, I think. I mean, and with all apologies to our listeners here, that's one of the reasons why we really haven't gotten to it. Bernie lost ground on Tuesday. Yes, he won Delaware, but he lost ground in the delegate count.
Andre, we are setting up for what presumably looks more and more like it'll be the Trump-Clinton election. And Trump has made it clear, it's certainly in his statements in the past week, that he is going to play, he's going to use a gender card. He talks about Hillary Clinton playing the gender card, but he's all set to go after, he said the other day, I'll go after her, I'll go after Bill Clinton for his indiscretions. This is going to be a really nasty presidential campaign.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't think anybody should have any illusions about that. I think what we have to do is that going into this race, both candidates or both potential nominees are going to bring weaknesses to the table. So Donald Trump might not have a message that actually will appeal to the center, and that's going to hurt him. And then Hillary Clinton is not necessarily the most liked candidate, but she might be the kind of hold your nose, lesser of two evils type of candidate. And can she mobilize enough people because of the fact that she might not be, you know, the choice of especially many progressives in this particular race? So her question is mobilization. His question is whether or not he can pivot to the center and actually appeal to a median voter.
Todd, if this is the way that Trump decides to play it, and certainly she's going to give it right back to him, if this is the way Trump goes, talking about indiscretions, you know, of Bill Clinton's and all, how do you see the rest of the Republicans who are running in down ballot races responding to this?
By closing their eyes and putting their fingers in their ears and hoping it goes away. You know, there's one thing that I thought of for the first time at the RNC meeting. It seems like ages ago, but was maybe last week or the week before. I lose track. It's that one of the hits against Donald Trump has been that he has no mobilization effort, that he has no ground game. And what we talked about, what we heard about at the RNC, because I kept my mouth shut the whole time, was the tremendous strides that the Republican Party has made in terms of catching up to the turnout effort that the Democrats have had the last couple cycles. And one of the things that we are likely to see is what happens when you have the air game of Donald Trump with an actual ground game that has been developed. And so it might not be the route at the lower levels that a lot of folks are expecting. But I've also read a lot lately about, and this is an interesting idea, is that what used to be the center, which was working class, kind of nationalistic, primarily white voters, is now part of the Republican, and what we think of as the center may not be, there may not be a center anymore.
Interesting.
Yeah, and actually, one of Andrew's colleagues over at Emory, Alan Abramowitz, he's done a lot of work on polarization. And one of his, and I think he still holds with this position, that polarization in American politics is so great right now that you're not likely to see a whole lot of down ballot consequence for a Trump candidacy.
So it was funny. So he told our graduating undergraduates the other day that he basically was going to predict that Democrats would make gains in both chambers, probably not enough in the House to make a difference, but of course the Senate will be in play. So I think it was more kind of back of the envelope types of things. He didn't actually pull out numbers and he didn't have any graphs or tables, so I couldn't see what his figures were. But I mean, he's expecting that there will be some down ticket consequences, you know, as a result of this particular race. And I guess the rancor that
No sea change.
Yeah, he didn't call this a wave election.
I think there will be short term consequences and long term consequences. And the long term consequences are clearly about the Latino vote. After the last presidential election, the Republican National Committee did a report and said that they have to recruit and be appealing to Latino voters, because a Republican candidate for president needs about 40% of the Latino vote to be competitive. Donald Trump, I think, has lost Latino vote for a generation for the Republican Party with his rhetoric. He's currently over 80% negative with Latino voters, and it's probably only going to rise, which means it's already out of the reach, not mentioning the fact that over 70% of the women have a negative opinion of Donald Trump.
But to bring this back to Georgia, I think that the partisan, the hyper-partisan separation in Georgia really kind of buffers any changes Hillary Clinton might make.
Down ballot.
Yeah, I think Johnny Isaacson will probably set a high watermark for a Republican statewide in this election over whomever the Democrats end up with. There's no competition even for Tim Echols on the Public Service Commission statewide. And if you look at the legislative seats, there's maybe two or three state House seats, maybe one or two state Senate seats that are even competitive. So I don't think we'll really see much if any effect in Georgia.
Jim?
Well, and one reason you can thank for that is the religious liberty veto on Nathan Deal's part. I think you're going to see other states kind of deal with it in a different way, like North Carolina and such. The other thing, Bill, the other landmark that big thing that happened this week came out of Pew Research Center, and that is that you and I are on our way out. Millennials.
I already knew that.
Yeah, millennials are now the largest demographic group. They exceeded baby boomers now, and if you take a look at how millennials think about the Republican Party, I think 3 out of 4 have a disfavorable view of the GOP. That is a big problem.
Yeah, it's part of what you're saying, Billy, about the long game here.
Yeah, and I think we're entering a new era of progressivism in the United States. I think it's very similar to what happened in 1980 with Ronald Reagan, and we entered over a 35-year period of conservatism. I think we're seeing that shift the other way now.
All right, we are out of time for this week's show. Jim Galloway, thank you so much for being here. Democratic strategist Billy Linville, Republican consultant and editor of GeorgiaPundit.com, Todd Rehm, and Emory University Associate Professor of Political Science, Andra Gillespie. Dr. Gillespie, thank you for being here as well. Next Wednesday on the 2 o'clock edition of Political Rewind, a couple things. We'll be assessing what happened in Indiana. It's conceivable if Trump pulls it off, we'll be talking about the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party and how he's going to plan his convention. We're also going to have your colleague, Aaron Gould Shinen, come in, talk about the congressional races in Georgia. There's some fascinating stuff going on there, Jim.
Bit on the Republican side especially.
Okay, so we'll look forward to that next Wednesday afternoon. Real briefly, if you're a real political junkie, this week Two-Way Street will appeal to you. We have a conversation with Randall Woods. He's a distinguished professor of history at University of Arkansas. His new book is called Prisoners of Hope, Lyndon B. Johnson, The Great Society, The Limits of Liberalism. On one hand, the book describes in great detail how LBJ passed this blizzard of legislation for the social good, but also how some of it backfired and hurt the very people he hoped that it was going to help. That's Saturday at 4, Sunday morning at 11. It was recorded in front of a live audience at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library. So I hope you'll tune in for that. In the meantime, I'm Bill Nygut. Our thanks to Jenny Ament, producer extraordinaire, for her work on the show today. See you all again next week.